Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. This is a moment that could and should perhaps change how business is done in America. Companies will be remembered for how they treat workers. Innovative leaders who find a way to keep going and keep their employees whole will survive and perhaps even thrive. That's a moral imperative, and it's good for everyone, and it is also the clarion call that Mark Cuban is making to his fellow business elite right now. The owner of the Dallas Mavericks joins us to talk about it. So this hour in point, Mark Cuban on doing business in a global pandemic. And Mark Cuban joins us today from Dallas, Texas. He is, of course, the owner of the Dallas Mavericks, an investor and entrepreneur as well, and you probably have seen him on the ABC show Shark Tank. Mark Cuban, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So I wonder if you might start by actually taking us back a month to when the NBA announced that it was going to suspend its season. I think that was the moment that really opened a lot of Americans' eyes to how big the pandemic or how much it was going to have an impact on the United States. So what was your first response? Take us back to that moment.
Shock.
What happened?
Yeah, I was stunned. I mean, literally, we had had a conversation before that game on March 11th and discussed, okay, would the game get postponed? Could the season possibly be postponed or suspended? And based off of what I knew back then, I thought, you know, maybe a 5 or 10% chance that something dramatic like that could happen. And then the game's going on and, you know, we had a full house. And so I thought, okay, well, if, you know, 17, 18,000 people felt safe enough to come out, you know, maybe, you know, it's not as bad as I thought. And then third quarter comes along and I get the notification that the season's been suspended and we're the last game playing. And it just stunned me. I literally was shocked.
You've never seen anything like it, right? I don't think the NBA has ever done anything like this.
No, of course, no. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's to, you know, postpone a season. Maybe the closest thing is when the earthquake hit, Major League Baseball World Series game. But, I mean, it was just stunning.
Yeah. I mean, I'm seeing here, just to see if we can tease any news out of you, that NBA Commissioner Adam Silver, he's still not saying whether the NBA is going to resume the season before May. I think he just said that yesterday. Do you have any more information on that?
No, I mean, because this is all going to be science-driven. I mean, the number one priority is safety.
Yeah.
There's no way we're going to put the safety of any of our employees, whether the janitor or the players or our fans or customers, at risk. It's just something that's not even conceivable. So once the science is there, I'm sure that's when Adam will make a decision.
Okay. All right. So then, Mark Cuban, take us then to, like, how did your – in after that first sort of shock receded and, like, okay, this is big, this is happening – where did your mind go? How did you pivot? What did you think was the next important thing to really take on?
I mean, I had to, you know, what was going to happen to all the people that worked for me,
yeah,
all the people that were in the arena that night, you know, that were just doing their job. You know, they live paycheck to paycheck, get paid by the hour, you know, never have 100% certainty on the number of hours they were going to have. And so that was my first thought. And you know, the first reaction was, okay, we're going to pay all them no matter what, because you know, once the hourly workers in the arena hear that the season's suspended, that's going to be their first thought. How am I going to pay their bills? And I wanted to answer that thought with, we'll keep on paying you as if the season were continued to be played and you don't have to worry about it.
Okay, so can you take us into how you actually did that? Because I think a lot of people are, you know, like, did the Mavericks, did you, who had the money to be sure that that happened, even if, like, you weren't getting revenue from people coming in to watch games?
My money.
Yeah,
it's my money,
yeah.
And I just paid them as if all the games were played. So they received their paychecks normally. I didn't want them to have any interruption in anything, anything that was going on in their lives. And so we just paid them normally.
And you committed to doing that for what, for at least a month?
Oh, no. Well, I mean, for the rest of the season,
the
whatever game.
Okay.
Yeah, and hopefully playoffs too. So hopefully the Mavs will be back, and I'll be paying them for playoffs and then some. And then we also tried to get them extra hours. You know, we're doing a lot of work trying to provide food to healthcare workers, frontline healthcare workers, and during their breaks, providing them different food from different restaurants. And so we hired some of them to do that to give them extra income in addition.
I got it. Okay. So let me ask you, it seems like we'll dig into a lot of the things that you're saying to the world of American business right now. But do you see this as a moment where how business is done in the United States could or should change?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, of anything, as devastating and dangerous as the coronavirus has been, it's also been a great equalizer. I mean, it can affect anybody, but within the business construct, just the idea that everybody has got to do their job or participate in a way that works for not just the business, but for the individual families, but also customers. And so, you know, I think it doesn't matter what your role is, each role is of equal importance. The CEO's of no more importance than, you know, somebody, you know, cleaning the floors or that takes a bucket and mops the floors. You know, that I think that this is a time as a reset where we really have to reevaluate how we treat workers, how people are paid, how can we get them into a role where they're receiving equity as part of their compensation so that they're not having to live paycheck to paycheck. They have something that appreciates. All these things, I think, are important as we, you know, go through this reset in business.
You sound like Mark Cuban, the proletarian radical now.
No, I've always felt this way. Well, maybe not always. I guess as things have gone better for me, you start to realize that, you know, because I when I started off as a bartender and barback and got fired from jobs and lived six guys in a three-bedroom apartment, you know, ate mustard and ketchup sandwiches, all the stories you hear, you know, that was me. And so I recognize, you know, the pain of having my lights turned off, of pain of having a credit card cut up, you know, or getting turned down. And so, you know, it wasn't something that was brand new to me. Maybe it just, as things went better for me, it just made me more aware of people that were still in the position that I was once in.
Yeah. You know, but when I hear you say things like give workers an equity stake in the companies that they work for, it might not be a new thought for you, but look, it wasn't that long ago where that was almost unthinkable in the United States, or people would laugh at the proposal. I mean, it feels like things are really, like, there's a paradigm shift going on. When you say that now, do people take you seriously? Like, maybe we ought to consider this?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, because I've always done it. I mean, I started my first company after I got fired and while I was sleeping on the floor, and I gave everybody equity. And when I sold that company, they made almost as much in aggregate as I did. And then when I sold Broadcast.com, my streaming company, which is where I made most of my money, out of 330 employees, 300 became millionaires. And, you know, and I've done it with other companies that I've started and sold. And so it's always been important to me. And, you know, hopefully it's starting to resonate more. And I know I'm not the only one. I don't want to make it sound that way. Because I, you know, there's other entrepreneurs that I've spoken with that have done the same thing and rewarded their employees even with more than I have. And so, you know, I'm not unique in this, but I certainly would like to see it happen more often. Because if we're going to deal with income inequality, it's not just about how much per hour, how much salary those who are making the least can get a raise for. You want them to be able to have assets that appreciate so that, you know, if it's equity in the company that you work for, as the value of the company goes up and maybe is sold, then you stand to benefit significantly. If you're able to buy a home, we've seen what happened when homes appreciate in value and you gain equity there. That acts as a cushion that people who, you know, are working by the hour, the 77 million people, or at least before all this hit, 77 million people that were in that position just didn't have the luxury of seeing their net worth increase. And I think the only way to address that directly is by giving them assets that appreciate, and equity in the companies they work for is the most logical and first step.
Mm. Well, we are talking this hour with Mark Cuban. He is the owner of the Dallas Mavericks. You've probably also seen him on ABC's Shark Tank as well. And while he says he's not alone in making the call or a clarion call that the way America does business ought to change, he's a big voice in that. Now, Mark, what do you think the future might hold for businesses or business leaders that don't see this, you know, catastrophe as an opportunity to pivot to something better?
Their brand is going to get destroyed. I mean, how you treat your employees today will have more impact on your brand in future years than any amount of advertising, any amount of anything you literally could do. Because, again, we're all suffering from this. every single person is looking to see how their company is treating them, how their employers are treating family members and friends. And we live in a social media universe now, and when people are not treated well, everybody around them is going to know. It used to be if, you know, the business mantra was if you do something good, one person hears about it. If you make a mistake, 20 people hear about it. Now, if you do something good or bad, hundreds, if not thousands, and potentially millions of people read or hear or see it. And the other part of that is, you know, in this social media environment, particularly for Generation Gen Z and millennials, they so identify themselves on social media. It's almost as if they're every individual is a brand. And the companies you associate yourself with, you present on social media, and you only want to present things that put you in a good light. And so if you're wearing a T-shirt for a company that's now done something that you think is not considerate to its employees or customers or whoever, you know, and you already have a picture in their T-shirt, you're taking it down. Or if it's a clothing brand and they do something that doesn't represent your values, you're taking it down. And on the flip side, if you see companies that do represent your values, you're going out of your way to do business with them. I mean, we see it on Shark Tank all the time. Companies come in now with social components. You know, buy a pair of socks, we'll give a pair of socks to the homeless. You know, I have a company, Combat Flip-Flops. Buy a pair of their flip-flops, and they'll invest money to build schools in Afghanistan for young girls who otherwise wouldn't get the chance to go to school. And you just see example after example of that coming from companies run by young CEOs. And if, you know, the old school CEOs don't recognize that that's what's going on now, their brands are going to suffer mightily.
Mm. Well, we'll talk more about the pressures against that double bottom line, as they say in the business world, when we come back. So Mark Cuban, owner of the Dallas Mavericks, stand by it for just a moment. We're talking about how American business or the way of doing business could or should change because of the transformative effect of the coronavirus pandemic. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about how the COVID-19 global pandemic could or should change the way that America does business, and specifically focusing on America's business elite. And I'm joined today to have this conversation by Mark Cuban. He is the owner of the Dallas Mavericks, an investor on ABC's Shark Tank. He's with us from Dallas, Texas. And Mark, let me ask you, so earlier you said if businesses don't treat their workers right now, it could destroy their brands because everybody will see what's happening. And there's a long-term impact on that. When we come out of this, people won't buy from those companies is what you're saying. But look, like reality check here, since this is an all-encompassing catastrophe that we're all trying to deal with, we'll probably see a lot of companies say, and even big corporations say, well, we were doing the best we could, and that was the best option we had at the moment, that putting people on furlough or unemployment is what let them get access to benefits, for example. So it's not our fault.
Right. No question. That's absolutely going to happen. But how they deal with those employees that they're furloughing or laying off or firing is critical, because we all realize that business and life has changed. And so if that company, big or small, communicates with the employee and says, look, here's where we're at. is transparent and honest and says, we, you know, here's exactly what's going on. You know, maybe we've applied for the stimulus program. And if we're able to get the stimulus program, which in essence turns into a grant, if we rehire you, then the employee most likely is going to respect and understand that. If the employer just says, sorry, we got to cut everybody, business sucks, they're not going to get the benefit of the doubt. And that's the same with small companies as well. You know, the stimulus programs that have been put in place, they can serve a really good purpose of keeping employees retained. And I'm guessing that almost every business that's impacted is going to apply. But the process is going to have its ups and downs and its delays. And so what I've been telling all my portfolio companies is you have to communicate. You have to talk to people as directly as you can. You have to be transparent. Tell them exactly what's going on. And you have to be brutally, brutally honest. You can't pull any punches. You can't try to, you know, sugarcoat things. You just have to tell them exactly the way it is and give them realistic timelines. And I think even though there's going to be bad news, and obviously there already has been bad news, if you're honest, then I think employees will respect that. And on top of it, if we do see a rebound, or I think when we see a rebound, those employers who treated the employees that they let go with respect will have the better chance of getting them to return. And that's going to be very important if we are able to get the level of rebound that we need and want.
Okay, so what does it actually look like in practice? For example, and here's why I ask. I was just looking at a story. And this is so big. I was just looking at a story from last week that Sephora, right, the company, they employ about 13,000 people. They had to lay off, or they laid off 3,000 people just last week on Tuesday, a week ago today. And some of those people, I mean, they tried to handle it, I guess, in the best way that they felt possible. They offered severance. They're providing support and resources, coordination with other companies that maybe that provide essential services and could be hiring. They also let some of their employees know about the layoff through a conference call. I mean, it was right. A real blow to people. Is that the way to do it, or is there a better way?
Yeah, look, you're not going to make 100% of the people happy all the time, right? That's just a given. And I think there's best from – I've read the same stories, and I think they tried their very best. Maybe the only thing I would have done is had more details in terms of the economics, you know, that they're going to apply for a stimulus loan that, you know, that we expect to bring back X percentage of employees. And if we hit these numbers in sales, or if we're reopened by these dates, that number goes to this, this, and this, so that there's benchmarks that employees understand that may create the opportunity for them to come back. Mm. You know, and they also help them with, you know, explaining to them how to sign up for government benefits, for employment benefits. And so, you know, when you deal with imperfect information, you're never going to make perfect decisions and you're never going to make everybody happy. But I think all in all, Sephora tried their best, but like any other time, you could always do better.
Yeah. Well, so there are many, many Americans who are still questioning whether or not all these layoffs are necessary. And I want to just play a voicemail that we got from one of our listeners. This is Ben from Johnson City, Tennessee, and he is questioning his employer's decision to lay off so many workers so quickly.
I personally don't think that these mass layoffs were necessary at all, especially in the case of myself and my fellow coworkers where I worked. We didn't really even get warning. We just suddenly got a call on the 29th of last month from our individual store managers saying, hey, best of luck, reapply whenever all this is over if you still want to be part of the store family. And I really think that this whole situation is highlighting a lot of flaws in the system that we currently have.
That's Ben from Johnson City, Tennessee. I mean, Mark Cuban, you were able to keep the workers at for the Mavericks whole out of your own pocket. Now, obviously,
right,
not every employee has an employer that can do that. So what's your response to Ben's concerns here?
Well, Ben obviously was not treated correctly. I mean, it's one thing to be honest, as I said, and transparent with your employees and say, look, our stores are closed. My personal financial is I can't afford to keep you on. What I'd like to do, Ben, is I'm going to apply for the Paycheck Protection Program. I don't know exactly when I'll be able to get that, but since the store is closed, we'll be eligible, and they obviously have to have under 500 employees as well. And Ben, if I get those dollars, you're going to come right back, and I'll even pay you for the time you missed. Because that's the goal of this stimulus plan, the Paycheck Protection Program, is to keep people employed. And the government will literally pay your payroll if you retain those employees. So the employer lost a great opportunity to retain goodwill with Ben. It probably is going to lose a great opportunity to get reimbursed for those paychecks and maybe just didn't do their homework, you know. And so based off of what Ben said in the voicemail, you know, that was just a mistake and a horrible mistake by his employer.
Yeah. Maybe I'm a cynic here, Mr. Cuban, but I just wonder.
Cynics are good. That's okay.
Okay.
That's hard too.
I just wonder if corporations will ever learn. I mean, we have gone through a generation for multiple different points in that generation of, and I'm focused on corporate here, on corporate layoffs were as soulless as they could possibly be. I mean, everyone has got a story about either themselves or someone they know being walked into an office. They know what's going to happen. They're told, yep, you're on the chopping block. And then they're just escorted straight out the building. I mean, that's a simplification, but it's true. What makes this moment any different that says that maybe business leaders might learn to handle these things differently?
Because this moment is the definition of difference. You know, and this moment is something that is defining us all and changing us all from the top of the food chain to the economic bottom of the food chain. And because of that, it's a unique opportunity for workers to speak their voice. The government, for the first time ever, is providing loans that don't have to be repaid. And that's everybody's taxpayer money, so we should have a voice there as well. And so while I understand your point, and I'm a cynic at heart as well, that you can't expect all corporations to be good, you know, compassionate capitalists. And, you know, if they were, you know, we wouldn't see the rise of Bernie Sanders at all. And democratic socialism wouldn't be a discussion at all. But now is a different time. Now is a time when every employee should speak up and really be able to say, look, let's look at this differently. Let's do this differently because you're going to need me as much as I need you. And it's not going to happen across the board. I mean, the cynic in me says, of course, you know, some big percentage of companies aren't going to get it. But at the same time, if enough companies do get it and those companies do better and set a prime example of how a company should be run in America 2.0, then I think that's how you get momentum.
America 2.0. Okay, so a little more cynicism here, and then I'm going to turn it over to our then I'm going to turn it over to our listeners because they really want to talk to you. But okay, 2008. It was also it was big. Now, granted, perhaps big in a different way.
Yes.
We had a chance there too. We had an imperfect bill in the Dodd-Frank bill that forced some changes, but I still am not sure that there's adequate evidence that corporate leadership in America, America's business elite, really learned long-term lessons from that in terms of changing their whole mindset about what it means to lead as a business person in the United States. The reason why I want to just point that out is because I'm coming back to something you said earlier, like, hey, why don't we have more employees given an equity stake in the companies they work for? That is actually something that has been proposed in this presidential race itself, but it still seems to be something that it's like it's a hard sell in the United States. So, I mean, are we going to change?
Well, two different things there. One, in terms of 2008-09, you're right. It was handled horribly. Very few lessons were learned because it was mostly around financial and insurance institutions. And when you're dealing with derivatives and CDSs and complex financial instruments, not everybody understood it, and particularly our politicians didn't really understand what was going on. And so the bailout was geared just towards those banks and insurance companies. And nobody else really everybody was impacted, but not everybody got to benefit from those bailouts. This is where I think it's different. Now the bailouts but now the stimulus program is geared towards not just businesses, but individuals as well. And I was out there screaming loud and clear that when it comes to any type of bailouts at all, that somebody's got to be there negotiating for the taxpayer, negotiating for the employee. And even though we didn't get everything we wanted there, I think there were some things like no buybacks during the term of the loan plus 1 year, no dividends. There were a variety of things that were far better in plan than there was than they were in 2008 and 2009.
All right. Well, let's go to our callers. We are speaking this hour with Mark Cuban. He is the owner of the Dallas Mavericks. And he's saying, as you can hear him say, this is an inflection point, a historic inflection point in American business. And maybe it's the opportunity to change the way business is done in this country. Let's go to Anne, who's calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Anne, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. It's a real honor to speak to Mr. Cuban. So timing is everything. I'm in the process of starting a business, which is organizing downsizing, helping people get ready to make a move, and it's over. it's out there. So because my clients are saying, well, I would have hired you to do this, but I'm stuck home, so here we are. So my question, Mr. Cuban, is, you know, in every situation, no matter how horrible, there can sometimes be opportunity. And I'm trying to be on the positive of that. And I'm saying, you know, is there an opportunity for someone like myself, small business, independent contractor, is there going to be an opportunity that we can take from this?
The answer, yes. The answer, Anne, is yes. Now, the first question is, how long have you been in business?
I just started in, like, September of last year.
Okay, so, yeah, that's tough. Now, you can, as an independent contractor, apply for the PPP loans, and I would do so. Mm-hmm. So that's number one. Mm-hmm. And the bigger picture answer is there's going to be a lot of question marks of people not just downsizing and how to do it effectively, but also how do you get employees to return. So what I would do is I would start calling all your prospective clients and say, look, let me give you guidance. A lot of the things I just mentioned, if you're going to have to lay off more people, here's the way to best handle it. Here's the best way to communicate with them. When it's time to bring them back, maybe you're waiting for your PPP loan and you need to bring them back. Here's the best way to do that to get your people to come back. Or afterwards, when you're hoping business turns around, here's the best approach. So you're right. This is an opportunity for you. And even though you might be, you might not be able to close deals right this minute as much as you want to, by setting a foundation with your potential customers and staying in ongoing communication, is there any way I can help? Is there any information I can give you? If you're the one they're talking to when they need that service, you'll be the one they think of when they go to get that service. And that's where you have to take advantage of where we are right now.
Great idea. Thank you.
And thank you for your call. Let's go to Robert, who's calling us from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Robert, you're on the air.
Hi. I couldn't help but think about the stark contrast between Hobby Lobby that's here in Oklahoma City. And, you know, recently the CEO said no employee would be given any time, even if they're sick with coronavirus, and no paid time off, and everybody's got to tighten their belts. You know, there's a billionaire saying this who I think has a pretty similar story as Mark Cuban. So I couldn't help but think about that. We're right up the road in I-35 here in Oklahoma City. And so I just wonder how that will play out, you know, when things
open. Are you going to do business with Hobby Lobby at all?
Well, That's what I'm kind of divided about. You know, if Hobby Lobby does, you know, if their business does suffer quite a bit, I mean, they employ a lot of people here in town, and so that hurts our economy too. So
no question, but there'll be other hobbyists and lobbyists, and you know, there'll be other companies that pop up to fill that void. You know, that's the good side of capitalism. And hopefully they'll be a lot more compassionate than the owners of a Hobby Lobby. You know, so there's opportunity there, just like Ann in the previous call asked about opportunity. If Hobby Lobby starts to fall, yes, it's bad for their current employees, but it's also an opportunity for one of those furloughed or laid off employees to start a competitor or to fill those needs on Etsy or other online marketplaces. There's always a way to get there. You know, but and then part two to that is, you know, hopefully their employees will get together and maybe unionize, maybe form an organization that says, you know what, if you need us back, we've had the chance to talk. We've had the chance to organize ourselves, and we're going to operate not as individuals but as a group and see what happens. You know, now maybe that's going to make them even madder and make it so you have, you know, I don't know the people that own it, so you have to be considerate of that. But, you know, all those people can talk to each other. All those people can organize in one way or another and increase their strength to deal with the issue. So hopefully, if and when they go back, it doesn't happen again.
Well, Robert, thank you so much for that call. And I should just note that on Friday, April 3rd, Hobby Lobby announced that it would finally close all of its stores until further notice. It had kept some of its stores open. And in a statement that Hobby Lobby released on April 3rd, the company said, in order to allow our furloughed employees to take full advantage of the Pandemic Unemployment Compensation and Recovery Rebates Act, they are ending emergency leave pay and suspending use of company-provided paid time off in accordance with the requirements in the CARES Act. They're also saying that they will maintain medical, dental, life, and long-term disability benefits for employees while furloughed at least through May 1st, 2020. So that's what Hobby Lobby
says. Well, that's a good sign.
Yeah,
that's a good sign. Hopefully that's a real positive.
So at least for the next 30-ish days here. Well, Mark Cuban, we've got a lot more to talk about with you when we come back. So stand by for just a second. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, tomorrow on the show, we're going to talk about how the novel coronavirus operates inside our bodies, and specifically if there's tests for antibodies for the coronavirus. So we'll be focusing on serology. What's your question about immunity and how the coronavirus behaves inside our bodies? Leave us a voicemail at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That is for tomorrow's show. Today, we're talking to Mark Cuban. He is owner of the Dallas Mavericks, and he is out there using his very large platform to call for American business to change the way it operates in the midst of this really paradigm-shifting moment we're in with the global COVID-19 pandemic. Mark, I wanted to ask you, you've also said that it's not just so much how employers or companies treat their workers now. It's that this is an opportunity, even in the midst of this disaster, for companies themselves to pivot and be innovative in brand new ways for America 2.0, as you called it.
Correct. You know, in running any business, there's always moments, many, many moments where you say, you know what, if only I had the time, I would change this. If only I had the time, I would redo our marketing materials. If only I had the time, I would reach out and call this prospect or customer. If only I had the time, I would sit down with this employee who I think is really smart and brainstorm about new ideas. Now you have that time. You know, now when we're working from home or quarantine at home or, you know, you can take the time to do things you never found the time to do before. Some of the basic things are organizing marketing materials, rewriting content on your website, creating content. You know, there's just so many things that you can do. And at the top of the list, I would put reaching out to your customers and just saying hi. You know, when we're in this type of situation, we're all scared, if not terrified, at a certain level. And just hearing of, you know, from somebody, even if it's via email or a video call, whatever it may be, just to say, hi, how are you doing? Hey, I got, you know, would you mind if we just brainstorm some and, you know, just that intellectual stimulation can help your company and also connect you with your customer at a level and a depth that you were never able to do before.
Mm. So this sounds like something that could apply very readily to small or medium-sized businesses. What about America's biggest companies right now?
You know, they're probably having to do a lot of different types of brainstorming, if you will, you know, trying to plan of what comes next. You know, when we talk about America 2.0 and having this reset, we don't really know what it's going to look like on the other side. All we can do right now is guess. And for a big company, trying to estimate and understand not only how it impacts your existing business, but what kind of new businesses you need to enter and how your customers are going to respond to you is critical. Because if you get it wrong, you know, you could lose a lot. And so big companies are really going to have to be more innovative and try to really do more probabilistic planning, meaning they have to look at 10 different alternatives and assign the probability they see for each and then make decisions based on that, on where they'll spend their time. It won't be easy, but it has to be done. And so, you know, that's going to be a challenge for them. Mm-hmm. There's no other way around it. But again, they're going to have no choice but to do it.
Do you think for these big companies, specifically the publicly traded ones, that their shareholders would understand if the focus changed?
I think it doesn't matter. I think you have to put employees first, because if your organization, when you come back to work, if your company is not, you know, is not adaptive and agile and resilient and able to get back to work as quickly as possible, then it doesn't matter what shareholders think. But on the flip side, if you've done really well by your workers, they trust you, they're excited by your new vision, and they're really ready to come to work and get back at it, they feel safe when they go to work, then you're going to be able to get more done far more quickly than your competitors, and that's going to give you a huge advantage. And if you look over, you know, a one-year time frame, maybe your shareholder price, your stock price won't do as well. But if you look over a 5 or 10 year term, then you can probably beat your competitors and excel. And again, I'll go back to the fact, if you're that big public company and whatever bonuses that you give your executive management, you should give the same type of bonuses to every single person in your company. Mm-hmm. So if based off of salary, let's say you have a CEO that makes $1 million a year and they get $1 million in options or warrants or repriced stock shares, then the person making $26,000 or $36,000 a year should get 100% of their salary in the same type of bonus remuneration. Huh. That's going to be critical, because if you go back and you're saying, come on, everybody, we got to rally together, and everybody realizes the stock price is down and it can go way up if you do all this, they should be able to share in that upside as well. And it's good business, because your people are going to be a lot more fired up and committed to getting this done in uncertain times. And that, in the long term, will benefit your shareholders.
You know, Mark, the America 2.0 you're describing is really American capitalism 2.0, right? Because it sounds like you're advocating for a shift from, you know, what for 100 years was basically churn-based capitalism, right? Like, we cycle through workers as the company needs, to you're going from churn to like a kind of resilience model in capitalism.
Well, more of a compassionate capitalism, because, you know, workers are not fungible any longer. Workers have a platform. You have the gig economy that you'll compete with forever. And so you'll see a lot more workers who are free agents, if we can use that term. You know, way back when, people used to get a job at a big company and look for a career and retire with a gold watch and a pension. Those days are long gone. And because companies have gone away from that, now workers recognize that they're free agents and they're only going to stay if what you offer them is better than what the company down the street offers them. And so if you want to retain your workers, which is going to be critically important in America 2.0 as we transition to the other side, then you're going to have to treat them better. You're going to have to reward them. You're going to have to, you know, practice compassionate capitalism. And the company that, as we discussed earlier, that doesn't treat their workers well, their brand's going to suffer, their business is going to suffer, and, you know, the compassionate companies are going to do better. Mm. And on top of that, the political aspects of it, you know, you've got the right and you've got the left, and the reality is, this is a chance to do it again and, you know, reset capitalism to where everybody is treated fairly and considerately. And I think that benefits business and capitalists like me a lot. And I think the country ends up in a better place because we are compassionate.
I mean, the picture you're painting is an inspiring one, Mark, but I'm also, God, I can't shake the cynicism bone because I'm thinking when we got that tax cut that was passed earlier.
No, it was awful. That was a joke. Yeah, that was, I agree with you.
Well,
that
corporations said from the start they were not going to use the tax money to benefit workers.
Yeah, they bought back shares, yeah. And then they played games and said we gave a $1,000 bonus to everybody. You know, and everybody got, you know, some people got excited about that. And now when, you know, you wish they still had that money to give bonuses, they don't have it. No one's announcing any bonuses. So I hear you loudly and clearly that, you know, what happened with the tax cut was a mistake. And now, you know, how we go forward, you know, if you look at what's happening with taxes, there's so much forbearance that tax revenue for the smallest municipalities up to the federal government are going to drop dramatically. But budgets haven't been changed. And so there's going to be ongoing deficits that we have to start to address. And how we formulate our tax code so that those companies that have benefited throughout this, you know, and have done really well and have seen those profits increase, you know, what's going to be fair for them to pay? And that's going to have to be a conversation. We change that, the terminology and change the approach that, you know, it's not trickle down anymore. It's trickle up. What we do has got to start with benefiting the people who make the least, the people who work by the hour, because that's what's going to make the economy stronger. That, you know, it's funny how the government is giving everybody $1,200 checks that make $75K and under, but they, for tax policy, they think that you should give more at the top. Well, when things hit the fan, we did bottom-up economics. We gave everybody $1,200. And I think we have to take the same ideology, same approach to when we start formulating tax policy for America 2.0 so that we have trickle-up economics because we need more consumerism. You know, Ben Bernanke used to call it the helicopter drop. That is what we're seeing. That's what I think was smart. And we have to carry on that thought process as we go forward.
Okay, so we got a minute left, Mark. For you and the Mavericks and everyone who works for the Mavericks, what are your next steps? Are there fundamentals in how the Mavericks organization does business that you're going to change?
Hopefully I'm going to amplify it. You know, we've adapted now. So the fundamentals are take care of the people you work with, care about the people you work with, and every extra minute you have, help somebody in need. Because if we do that, again, it's trickle-up economics. That's compassionate capitalism. And then we can innovate from there. If we're doing things together and everybody's working together, we'll see new opportunities, start businesses around it, hire more people, and just rinse and repeat. We'll do the same thing over and over again. And if we do that, when we get to the other side, and that becomes a great example, then I think this country is in great shape. And I'll tell you, there's no other country I'd rather be in right now, because when it comes to innovation, resilience, starting companies, entrepreneurship, America dominates the world. And we need that innovation. We need that capitalism right now. We just have to add a little compassion from what we had before.
What about, would you consider raising the wages of those hourly workers?
Absolutely. Absolutely, you should. I mean, you know, I'm a big believer that, I'll tell you what I do with my companies. It would have been embarrassing for me to find out if any employee of mine was on government, on unemployment, right, or getting any type of government assistance at all, because that tells me I wasn't paying them enough to support their family. And so I went and had people go through and check as best we could, because not everybody's going to tell you if they're getting assistance. And we raised wages and we gave them enough to make sure that they weren't on public assistance. And I think that's the way every company should be, because to me as a capitalist, if I'm paying so little that my fellow taxpayers have to subsidize my company, that's just wrong. That's not capitalism. That's the ultimate in socialism. I'm taking from other taxpayers to subsidize my companies and my employees. And so, yes, I'm a firm believer that at least $15 has got to be the national minimum wage.
Well, Mark Cuban is the owner of the Dallas Mavericks. He spoke to us today from Dallas, Texas. Thank you so much for joining us, Mark. It was great to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Great questions. I really enjoyed them. I appreciate it.
All right. Well, we're going to wrap up this hour now with Jack Beattie, On Point's news analyst, who's with us, as always, from Hanover, New Hampshire. And Jack, I want to actually just take a couple of steps back from the details that Mark Cuban just offered us. And and ask you what you think of this larger moment in terms of American business and American workers.
Well, you've been using the metaphor of the mirror, that this crisis is showing us reflections of ourselves, not just as we are in a crisis, but as we are. The extreme situation is lighting up features of our normal existence, of our normal political economy. And I think what we're seeing crucially now is the difference between the middle class and working class, to use an old term that's come back, and that is insecurity of employment. That the insecurity of employment of people in the gig economy, people in the, you know, service industries, which has been a chronic feature of our, you know, job picture for a long time. I think that's so salient now. Middle class people getting their health care, getting their sick pay, getting their salaries. The contingent worker, no health care, if disjunct from the job, no sick pay and no pay. And I think that's just bringing out that fact that has been a crucial, just kind of dogs and in a way curses our brand of capitalism, curses it because after a point, the precarious worker can't consume, can't mm-hmm. keep the thing going. And somewhere out there, and you could hear it, I think, in Mark Cuban, is an enlightened self-interest that would say, wait a minute, unless the insecure worker has more money, this whole project of consumer-led capitalism is going to fail. Henry Ford had that insight when he raised the wages of his workers 100 years ago because they couldn't buy his cars. And yet by the end of the 1920s, you had underconsumption. People couldn't buy the things that were on offer. And that was one of the chronic problems that the Great Depression revealed.
Mm. Well, you know, so the Ford example is fascinating because it makes me wonder, what have we learned in the past century? Because that same insecurity for a generation amongst economic policymakers, it was seen as the source of nimbleness, right? Dynamism in the American economy, that we could make innovations and changes faster because of the lack of drag from policies that were put in other countries.
Yes, yes. And, you know, flexibility. Mm-hmm. Remember that? That mm-hmm. was the big deal. We could, you know, Winston Churchill made a great comment. He said, there's quite enough of the whetstone in life. We don't need any more of this, you know, economic insecurity to add to the vicissitudes of existence that everyone faces. And I think that shibboleth, you know, flexibility, you know, nimble, I think we're going to hear less. I hope we will hear less and less of that justification for inequality as we come out of this, when we come out of this.
Well, Jack, we have a minute and a half here. I was wondering if you have a example from literature that we could use as our guide.
Well, I do. I have a poem called Calling Him Back from Layoff by Bob Hickok, who was an auto worker at one point. Calling Him Back from Layoff. I called a man today. After he said hello and I said hello, came a pause during which it would have been confusing to say hello again. So I said, how are you doing? And guess what? He said, fine, and wondered aloud how I was. And it turns out I'm okay. He was on the couch watching Cars painted with ads for Budweiser follow Cars painting with ads for Tide around an oval. That's a metaphor for life, because most of us run out of gas and settle for getting drunk in the stands and shouting at someone in a T-shirt, we want kraut on our dog. I said he could have his job back. And during the pause that followed, the whiskers scrubbed the mouthpiece clean, and his breath passed in and out in the tidal fashion popular with mammals until he broke through with the words, how soon, thank you, oh my God, which crossed his lips and drove through the wires on the backs of ions as one long word, as one hard prayer.
Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst, thank you so much. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.